And you unfortunate people are stuck with me. All righty. It's been close to 4 months since I had Sunday school. So I'm going to recap a little bit. If you will remember, and the reason why I say that, if you'll remember, is because I had forgotten. I could not remember what I was teaching. And then I went to look for my notes, and I couldn't find my notes. And I finally found them. I'd put them up. I'd put them in my little box that I throw all my old notes in. And I had just plain forgot. So it's amazing. Anyway, I had to recap myself. I'll try to recap a little bit, but I'm not going to recap a whole lot. If you want to know more about what I'm dealing with here, you can go back into our audio archives on our website, and they are there. It's there in February. I had my class, and I taught on the day that's approaching, that special day that God always mentions in the Bible, that's constant reference. It's a consistent looking for of that day. If you'll look in Hebrews chapter 10, I'm going to read verse 25. Let's go ahead and read 23 through 25. Anyway, it says, let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Most of this verse and most of this passage is dealing with how we ought to act as we see the day approaching. But I had divided this Sunday school lesson, this series that I was doing, into three heads. And the three heads were, first of all, the consistent expectation of a coming day, the end of the world. Throughout the Bible, it's always talking about the day that's coming. It will surprise you how often that those last days are mentioned. Hannah mentions it in her song of deliverance. She mentions the last days. It talks about the last days, even in the first chapters of Genesis, the first part of Genesis. It mentions the last days even later on. It gets over there into David. David mentions the last days, and Isaiah and Jeremiah, they mention the last days. Always talking about a culmination of history where everything ends, and it ends in a glorious day for God. Now, however you want to divide this up, or however you want to interpret these passages, and there's many ways to do it, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm not really interested in a debate over it. I think I pretty much have a basic understanding of what's going to happen. But the point is, throughout the Bible, he's telling us, be expecting the end. And this passage right here says, you can see the end approaching. That's the second head that I'm on, and that's where I left off last time in this second section of the series that I'm doing, and that is, how can you see the day approaching? Many people have claimed they knew when it was going to happen, and they were wrong. We don't want to be foolish. We don't want to be wrong. I mean, some of us have been wrong an awful lot. And so it does, you know, there's no skin off our nose. We're wrong again. You know, it's not a big deal. But those of us who just almost are never wrong, you got to be careful here, because you're going to mess up here. You might think something, you see something and you might be wrong. And a whole lot of people have thought, boys, like a revelation, bang. Oh, wow. I see something. And they thought they knew when the day was going to come, and they were wrong. You'll remember that, that fella, Miller, he was a Baptist preacher back in the 1800s. He was a good man, a saved man, and a very strong student of the Bible. And he got to noticing over there in, I believe it was in Leviticus, where he says that Israel would be punished seven times for their sins. And so he started calculating up from the year 606 BC and figured that times is a year. So not just 7 years, but he figured that since the day equals a year prophecy, you know, so he says 360 years, days in every year. So each day is a year. So he multiplied 360 times seven, and it came out, and the date was going to be 1844. And he got to thinking, wow, and it was like 1842 at that time, and he got to thinking, God has revealed this to me. So he starts going around and preaching, the Lord's coming back in 1844. Come 1844, and he didn't come back. So then he realized that there's no year zero. So then he says, it's 1845. It's going to be 1845. So they went out and waited till 1845, and he didn't come back in 1845 either. And to his credit, he stood up and said, I was wrong. And he stopped preaching that stuff, and he went back to his old pastoring ways and just did the normal thing, which is what he should have done from the start. He doesn't say, go sit on a mountain. What he says is, occupy till I come, right? So we keep on working, even if we know the day. But Jesus clearly says we don't know the day. And he even said at his time, he said he didn't even know the day. So it's a hidden thing. It's a hidden thing. I remember Willie Cosby told me one time, he thought that the day was not fixed yet. He says it was in his power. He was going to decide someday when it was going to happen. And I don't know whether that's true or not. I know that the Bible focuses on a day, but then the Bible also says you can see it approaching. Do you have any doubt about being able to see it approaching? That's what I'm dealing with in this second section of my series. And the third section is going to be, what does the Bible tell us we ought to be doing if we see the day approaching? That is, there is a certain change in life that should happen if you can see the day approaching. And I have noticed that self-discipline is not enough to get you to do the right thing. What I've noticed is you got to be persuaded of something. It's got to get in deep. It's got to get in deep. And if you get persuaded of something, it'll change your life. I got persuaded about something when I was in my teens. I got persuaded that I was going to die. Not just that I knew it. I knew I was going to die. I mean, that was the standard knowledge. You know you're going to die. Even little kids know you're going to die, right? But I hadn't been persuaded of it. And then I'm supposing it's because my grandfather died, and it just struck me, I'm going to die. And God didn't let me lose that thought. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And I decided, well, since I'm going to die, eventually, this life is just not worth living for. It's not this life. I've got to do something eternal, something lasting, something that will go past the grave. And then God called me to preach, and man, you know, I haven't lost that vision yet. God truly changed my mind. And so if you could see the day approaching, it might change your mind too and make you a little wiser about how you live your life, especially as you get closer to that day. All right, I'm in the second section of this where I'm trying to show you certain ways you can see the day approaching. And just to recap, there are some indicators. There are some signs that have historically been used to suppose that the day is close. I know that people have said, I remember studies on earthquakes, and they were saying that earthquakes have become more and more, they're more severe and they're more often. And I actually saw somebody with a whole graph, and I don't remember whether he was a preacher in our church or whether I'd seen him on the television or something. I don't know. But he had graphs and everything about how earthquakes getting worse and what have you. And so I did my own little research recently, especially after I realized how wrong I had been in trusting these types of signs. So I did my own research, and it turns out that there is no evidence that earthquakes are getting worse or more often. So that's, to me, that's not a very good sign in my mind. And then they talk about wars and rumors of wars, and it's true, in the 20th century we had the worst wars that had ever happened. There were some bad wars in the 20th century. But the truth is, there's been bad wars throughout history. I mean, throughout history, some really bad wars. And in fact, we've had relative peace lately. I know we've got some little wars going on, but since the nuclear bomb, the big powers have been a little more hesitant to get into a major war because, you're talking about existential threat. You could actually blow each other up and destroy yourselves, and so they're afraid. I don't know that a multiplicity of wars is a good indicator that we are in the last days. I don't think you should be counting on wars or trying to figure out a way to calculate, because that's just not a clear indicator. They also say pestilences. Jesus says these are the beginnings of sorrows. You'll have pestilences. And, you know, we see COVID, and a whole lot of people talk about COVID being a sign of the end because there's going to be pestilences. And yet, if you look in history, there have been some really bad pestilences, much worse than COVID and much worse than anything we've seen lately. So none of those to me are very good indicators that we are in the last days or that the day is approaching. I've also noticed some sort of inadvertent prophecies in the Bible that sort of give me a clue that there might be. And I think these are more usable. For example, the Bible speaks about mass communication. Talks over there in Revelation, I believe it's chapter 11, where he says those two witnesses are going to be killed, and the whole world is going to wonder after them when they see these witnesses laying on the street, and then their dead bodies come to life again after 3.5 days. Wow. But it says the whole world's going to wonder about that. And back in the day when that was written, the whole world didn't wonder about anything. The whole world had whole different problems in different areas. Something happened in Jerusalem, the rest of the world didn't care. It was not a thing. The news didn't reach you for months and months if it was even news you would care about. And most people wouldn't have cared about it. How in the world could the Bible inadvertently predict that the whole world's going to be able to see two people laying on the streets of Jerusalem? Well, that's an indication that in the last days there's going to be mass communication that is beyond anything they had imagined. They could not have explained it or expected it, and yet the Bible tells you that it was going to happen. So mass communication, Daniel chapter 12 says that knowledge shall be increased. Do you realize how knowledge has increased? We got so much knowledge now, nobody can get a grasp on it. Nobody can get a grasp, even on one field. You just take one field, and all the fields of study are narrowing down every year, narrowing farther and farther, because there's just so much knowledge. You will wear yourself out trying to figure out everything in just one field. It's amazing how much knowledge there is. That's science. Science. We have exploded scientific knowledge. That's what Daniel says. Knowledge in the last days, knowledge shall increase. It also says they shall run to and fro, indicating that travel will be increased. And back in the day, I'm talking about in the day when these things were written, most people did not travel. In fact, you'll find the book of Proverbs talks about the danger of travel. The danger of travel mentions the traveling man's in danger, always in danger. And that's why, because wherever you went, there were highwaymen, you were out of your element, you were out of your protected area, and you were in danger if you traveled. People didn't travel. There, people would be born in one little village, and they wouldn't leave that village until they died. That was the way things were back then. But it says then they're going to be going to and fro all over the earth. And boy, isn't that the case. They're going everywhere all the time. The skies are filled with airplanes. Now, those are inadvertent predictions. They weren't set out as prophecies saying, notice that this, but they were predictions that if you pay attention to the Bible, it ought to give you a little bit of confidence that these are the days they were talking about. We are in the days. Things are falling into place as we can see it. Jesus talks about the days of Noah. As in the days of Noah, so it's going to be in the end of the world. Now, the days of Noah were marked by prosperity and everything being, you know, at peace and tranquil. He says in the days of Noah, they were marrying and giving in marriage, and they were planting and they were building and they were, oh yeah, this was a going economy back in the days of Noah until the day. And then it was too late. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, if you watch these end of the world movies, these apocalyptic movies, you see that, you know, you're going to have some kind of wars and everybody's going to be destitute, you know, and we're all going to be fighting over food and stuff. But what the Bible says is the day's going to come in a day like the days of Noah, when everything looks perfectly well and fine and prosperous, and there's not going to be any horrible worries about things like that. No, it's going to be times where they're going to be talking about peace and safety and wanting improvement in their life and more prosperity, and that's all we talk about nowadays. Oh man, all every election's about jobs. And it makes me wonder, why in the world are they making the election about jobs? I know if you don't have a job, that might seem very important. But the truth is, there are a lot of things more important than prosperity. There are a lot of things more important. Anyway, Revelation 18, I don't know if you've read that about the world in the last days. It talks about a tremendous consumerism. They have all these merchandise that they have, and it just mentions all the things, including oil and wood and souls of men and things of that nature. It's an interesting thing how inadvertently God is mentioning what's going to happen in the end, clarifying that he expected it to be like it is today, in a way that those people who wrote it in those days could not have known. This is God giving us indications. I also see possibilities in things like the Church of Laodicea. Laodicea meaning the people rule, or what the people have dominion, civil rights, and I see that as what has happened in the last days of the world. We're in a world where civil rights and people rule and democracy and all that. It's on almost every single country in the world claims to be a democracy, because that's now the new standard. Even the dictatorships consider themselves to be democracies, because that's the new standard. And that's an inadvertent prophecy about the end times that they could not have known when they talked about Laodicea being the people rule. Anyway. Now, those are slight indications, I think, not very firm, but they do give you some confidence. I did go into one or two my last time that I had, and that's where I'm going to take up from there. The first thing, when I get to some major indicators that we are in the last days, and you can be convinced we're close. The first one, of course, is the restoration of Israel as a nation. That we talked about extensively in February, my last Sunday school, and so I will not go into it again, just to remind you that 200 years ago, nobody thought that Israel would become a nation again in the Holy Land. It was just, except a few Christians. There were a few Christian outliers, a few Puritans that had this firm evangelical biblical belief that those prophecies of the Old Testament were going to be fulfilled. I don't know if you realize it, but most Christians throughout history have endorsed what's called replacement theology. They believe, and they still do. I'm talking about 90% of people who call themselves Christians. Maybe I'm guessing at the percentage, but a vast majority of people who call themselves Christians and follow some kind of a Christian tradition, they believe in replacement theology, that the nation of Israel has been replaced by the church. And so all of the promises that the Bible gives to the nation of Israel, the natural seed of Abraham, those things have been taken away from them and given to the church, people like you and me, and the church now has the rights to all those, and the prophecies are going to be fulfilled in the church in a spiritual way rather than how they actually were spoken. The problem is, if you start reading the Old Testament and look at those prophecies, what you find out is they're very specific. They go into very specific detail about, he makes some kind of incredible claims, like, if there's still day and night, then my covenant with Israel has not ended. And folks, there's still day and night. So in my mind, he still has a covenant with that natural seed of Abraham, Israel. And if you start reading the Bible with a view that God has not cast away his people, but he will still bring them back to himself in his time, if you read the Bible that way and understand it, well, then you don't follow this replacement theology type of thing. And so you start paying attention to that, and you start expecting God to do something with the nation of Israel. And that's what happened, especially after the Inquisition, when Spain, I don't know if you guys realize, during the Reformation, Spain started trying to clear out the Counter-Reformation, trying to clear out all the Protestants and they just decided for good measure to clear out all the Jews out of Spain. And so they started killing them. They started burning them at the stake. Well, not the Jews so much, but they would burn the Protestants at the stake. And the Jews, they would just steal all their money and things like that. Well, the Jews fled and the Protestants fled. And that happened also in England, where there was some severe persecution against the Protestants in England, a sort of Bible-believing group of Christians. And so they all fled to one country that happened to be a free-for-all. Anybody could go there, and that was Holland. And so what you had was a bunch of Jews going north from Spain that landed in Holland, and you had a bunch of Puritan Christians going from England over to across the channel and getting to Holland, and they got to communicating, and it made these Puritans realize these Jews have not been given up by God. They stopped believing in this replacement theology and started believing that God was doing something with those Jews. And from that time on, you've had what you call Christian Zionism. And Christian Zionism is there's been a subset of Christians that have just believed that God is going to restore the Jews to their land, restore the temple, and then cause all of those prophecies to happen exactly like they say in the Old Testament. Now, that's what I believe. I think it's almost indisputable once you come to a certain understanding of the Bible. It becomes indisputable. That is what is happening. But they knew that before it happened. And so back in the 1800s, they started preaching it. These evangelicals, when evangelical Christianity became more and more popular and greater within the world, they started preaching this thing, and it created a movement of Christian Zionism. So that by the end of the 19th century, by the 1880s, 1890s, you had Jews themselves that were pressing for their own homeland. They weren't even certain that they could have their original homeland. They were actually talking about getting some country to give them some land somewhere else so they could create a new Israel. And, but because they weren't that clear. But not the Christians. The Christians wanted them back in their homeland. And so during World War I, I don't know if you realize it, but during World War I, England, which was nominally a Protestant country, and a whole lot of people there believed, they did not believe in replacement theology, they believed the Bible as it was, and when they went over there into North Africa and started fighting the Ottoman Empire and those groups over there, instead of going after the more strategic areas that the Ottoman Empire owned, these generals decided to go take over Palestine. And they did. And they tell you the reason they went to take over Palestine. They went there so that they could offer the Jews a place, they could control it and offer the Jews an opportunity to go back. And they did that. And that right after the war, I believe it was in 1917, they opened it up for Jews to immigrate there. And they had been immigrating there for the last 20 or 30 years at the time. But then it just flooded in. Oh my, were they flooding in. And, you know, they flooded in so much that it started... and by the way, they didn't just go in and steal the land. They went in and bought. They were paying top dollar prices for Arab lands, and the Arabs were selling it because, wow, all of a sudden, just like you San Antonians selling your houses to Californians now. They're offering you more than you ask for it. You say, I want $150,000 for my home. They'll come in there and four or five people will offer you $160,000 or $170,000. Well, that's what was happening in the Holy Land. And the Arabs were selling their land because it was worth more money than they could get anywhere else. And after a while, there were so many Jews there that the Arabs had to form some groups to start terrorizing them, trying to get it to stop. They wanted to stop all this immigration. And that caused a three-way war between Britain and Israel and the Arab population. And it took them about 20 years, but Britain says, I've had enough. Especially after World War II, they said, we've had enough. And they decided to up and leave. And they left in 1948. But right when they left in 1948, the United Nations says, okay, we're going to make Israel a nation. They were attacked, and they had a big war, and later on, I believe it was in 1949, the borders were established at what is now present-day Israel. And guess what? Israel is a nation. Now, that's something that could not have been imagined 300 or 400 years ago by most people in the world. But it's actually happened in our lifetime, and we're seeing it pan out right now. It is amazing. That is an amazing indication that we are in the last days. It is an amazing indication. It also caused Christians all over the world to start focusing on the last days. It truly turned the attention of Christianity. True Christians, good Bible-believing churches started really focusing on the last days because of what God did with the nation of Israel. That is by far the most significant, I think, of the indicators, that the fact that Israel is now a nation again, something prophesied many times in the Bible, and it actually now we can see things happening that that the Bible had claimed were going to happen, that just a couple hundred years ago was not feasible, was not practical, was not believable. Anyway, okay, the second indicator that I had, and I believe I covered this pretty well in February, and that was the harvest of the earth. That the Bible gave you the indicator that God, when He created the world, wanted it to be filled with humans. And I know we tend to lament all the cities and all the pavement and all the industries and the big old power plants and all the airports and the planes flying over there. We think that's horrible, but that's what God wanted. When He created humans, He did not expect then the earth to be an uninhabited wilderness. He did not expect it to be vast forests. What He expected was humans to take over the earth and subjugate it and be, and the Bible says, He told Adam, replenish the earth, make it full of people. And He said the same thing to Noah, replenish the earth, make it full of people, be fruitful and multiply. And boy, that's one commandment we have obeyed. We have been fruitful and multiplied, and there are people everywhere. And if you think there are people everywhere in the United States, go to Asia. Man, they are everywhere. And they're not just spread out. They're stacked on top of each other. They live in high rises that are higher than any city, any building in San Antonio. There are people living in apartments way higher than the Tower of the Americas. And that's all over the world this has happened. The world has been filled up. You remember over there in Revelation 14 where He said, where the God says to the angel, put forth your sickle and reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. God said, fill the earth, and then he's gonna reap it when it's ripe. I would say it's pretty ripe. Now, I know that they kind of make fun of us Christians because we're always talking about the end of the world. Well, the Bible talks about the end of the world an awful lot. The Bible mentions the end of the world. The world is not going to fade away someday in billions of years when the sun gets too hot. That's not what's going to happen. The world has a expiration date. He's got it set up so it can be harvested. And then He's going to do His bidding, and He's going to make a new heavens and a new earth. You might think that's real hard to do. It's not hard for God. He can just snap His fingers or just say the word, and He'll have a new heaven and a new earth, and it's going to be fantastic. He says, at His right hand are pleasures forevermore. You have not yet imagined what God has prepared for them that love Him. So the point that ought to be made here is that you think that Christians might be crazy for always talking about the end of the world. That's the attitude God wants us to have. This world is slated for an end. It's got an expiration date, and when it comes, God's going to do His will on this earth. But what He wanted it for it to happen, He wanted the earth to be full of people. Now, we're not the only ones talking about the end of the world, folks. They got this Green New Deal. Why? Because we only have 12 years to exist. We only have 12 years, folks. Why? Well, because the water's going to rise. I'm going to have oceanfront property pretty soon. And hurricanes are going to become devastating. Hey, listen, why do they call us crazy when we talk about the end of the world, but they can talk about the end of the world without any mocking? Or any scorning? Well, I guess we do a little scorning. I was a little bit mocking on my right there. Listen, they're talking about the end of the world all the time. They're talking about running out of water. They're talking about running out of petroleum. I know, at least since the Arab embargo of the 1970s, I know they've been talking about the end of fossil fuels. I mean, it's the end. And now we've got so many fossil fuels, they can't get it all. They can't go get it. And now they don't want to use it. They want to use renewables, even though that, you know, that's a problem in itself. But the reason why they do that is because we're running out of stuff. We've become a burden to the planet. Humans have become a burden to the planet. Now, I think it's all exaggerated personally, but that's just my personal opinion. I'm no expert. I personally think that's exaggerated. I don't think we're at the tipping point. I don't think we have 12 years to live. I am not afraid of global warming. I'm not afraid of a bigger hurricane season. That stuff does not affect me. I'm not worried about that. In fact, after this last winter, I could use a little heat. I'm not afraid of heat. I want the heat. Give me a little global warming. But the idea that you ought to really recognize is that the whole world knows we're full. There's no debate about this. The whole world knows the world is full. And it's not about everybody being crammed in like sardines, shoulder to shoulder. That's not what full means. It takes a certain amount of arable land to supply every single person with oxygen, food, and water. You have to have a certain amount of acreage per person for us to live, to exist. And the earth is there. It's close. We have enough people. God could look at the earth today and say, put in your sickle. It's ripe. That's the second major indicator that the day is approaching. And you can see it. This is not rocket science. You can see it. All right. How about number three? There's another concept of harvest. There's another concept of harvest. And that is when the wickedness gets great. Let's go into that. For example, Matthew 24:12. All of that I've said up to now, which has been about 30 minutes, has been a recap of what I've already covered before. So, sorry about that, but it's been several months. Matthew 24:12. Jesus says, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. He just inadvertently, or I should say peripherally, says, in those days coming toward the end of the world, when the disciples asked him, what are going to be the signs of your coming? And what's going to be the signs of the end of the world? And he mentions that iniquity shall abound. Now, a couple of hundred years ago, there were a whole lot of Christians. It was fashionable among Protestant Christians to believe that the world was going to get better and better and better and better until God just finally had to come because he missed us so bad. But that's called post-millennialism. That's the way of interpreting the Bible, thinking that the gospel was going to change the world in prosperity and in every other way, politically and all that. And that's because they lived in a bubble and things were going better in their neck of the woods. The rest of the world was suffering terribly. So they didn't really look at the whole picture. But that belief sort of fell by the wayside with the two world wars. They stopped believing that everything's getting better because it got real worse real fast. Anyway, now, if you look at the world, I don't think there's any room to believe that the world is becoming a better place. At least if we're talking about sin. Sin is becoming not only widespread and rampant, and we've always been sinners. The world has always been sinners, and there's almost no new kind of sin in the world that they didn't have back in Abraham's day. All the sins have been around since basically the beginning. But it's become more widespread, and it's become more acceptable, and it's even actually being prescribed by our government. They are actually making laws to force you to sin. It's everywhere. And we're all affected by it. Is this an indication of the end of days? Is this an indication that God says, I'm going to harvest them when their wickedness gets great enough? Let's see if that's the way it works. Look at Genesis chapter 6. One of the most amazing statements in the Bible, I think, Genesis chapter 6 tells you something about you as well as the world. Look at verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. I want you to just notice, we know what the story is. What the Bible says is that this world was destroyed by a flood. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and that was some rain. We've had a lot of rain the last two or three weeks, but the rain we've had the last two or three weeks is nothing compared to the rain that fell in those days. Even if all the land was the same height or whatever, and all the water that's in the oceans fell as rain, in 40 days and 40 nights, you're talking about a couple of yards of water per hour. That's a lot of rain. Nothing survives that kind of rain. That kind of rain washes everything away. And it covered the earth and destroyed the earth. But why? Why did it happen? And why did it happen when it happened? Because the wickedness of man was great in the earth. And God said, I am sorry I did that. Now, I know it doesn't make sense to talk about God as repenting or changing his mind, but God expressed that about himself. He said it's talking about an emotional reaction. He's not talking about his character and how he is. He's eternal and he doesn't change his mind. But in his emotional reaction to what he sees, he says, it makes me grieved in my heart that I made this evil people on this earth. He put people on the earth. He says he made them upright and they sought out many inventions, and look what they did. Their thoughts of their heart were only evil continually. Only evil continually. And that, even then he had patience and he says, I'm going to give them 120 years. He says, I'm going to give them 120 years. When he saw that their wickedness was great, he gave them 120 years more, but there was a limit. And when that 120 years was expired, bang, the flood came and took them all away. And the reason why was because the wickedness on the earth was great. I have to wonder what God is thinking right now when he looks at the earth. You got to wonder when he sees the sin cities, and there's thousands of sin cities. They're known for their deviant behavior. These cities are known for their most wicked devices that they've come to man. We're talking about the prostitution and the sex trafficking, and we're talking about little kiddie porn industries. We're talking about how many children have you seen? Have you gone? You can go to Walmart. You can go to the post office. You can see it on the cereal boxes or on the milk jugs, and it talks about a little kid that's been stolen. And guess what happens to them? What do you think? You think God doesn't care? He says, I'm going to do something about it. He has not overlooked what people are doing. And the abortion mills. And I would say you probably ought to just stay away from that single dose vaccination, because they use babies to make it. That Johnson & Johnson, they actually use little dead babies to make that single dose. I'm not trying to pick on you if you did it not knowing about it. I understand. And all of us are affected one way or the other. I'm just saying there's a reason to pay attention, because God notices this stuff. And when abortion becomes so defended by so many people who even claim to be Christians, you think God's not paying attention? He says he notices, he knows, and you know what happened when he saw it last time? He says, I'm taking them out. I am so sorry I did this. That's his emotional reaction. God has emotions too, and he doesn't like your sin. He doesn't like our sin, the world's sin. And when he gets to a certain point, it goes over the limit there. How about, let's go ahead and read Genesis 15. I'm not going to get into it deeply because I've only got about 4 or 5 minutes left in this lesson today. But I do want to point it out. I have pointed it out before. Genesis 15, 16 says, but in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Just to recap, God had promised Abraham the land that he was walking around on as his own personal property. And he promised it to him. He says, but it's not going to happen right now. Your seed is going to dwell in the land. They're going to be gone for 400 years. And in the fourth generation, and both of those things came exactly true, by the way, in the fourth generation, they're going to come back out again. But I can't give it to you now because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. The land was slated for destruction. But because there was something in God's mind saw that the iniquity wasn't quite there yet. The ripeness was not ready to be harvested yet. The iniquity, the evil of the Amorites, those children of Canaan, all those different tribes that came out of Canaan, that were cursed, they had some of the most evil religious practices there were. They were incredibly homosexual, predatory. They were evil people. And God said, yes, but it's not quite ready yet. And he made them wait 400 years. But the day came. But what was he waiting for? The iniquity to get to a certain stage. I wonder how close we are. But if you vex your soul every day at the behavior of the people around you, well, then you ought to be thinking the time is getting close. There's a reaping time coming. There's a reckoning coming. People are going to meet their maker. God is not going to let it keep going forever. He says, I see the wickedness, I see that it's great, and I'm going to do something about it. That's also considered the harvest. Let's go ahead and read Joel 3. Let's go ahead and read Joel 3:12. That's toward the end of the book of Joel. Right before he ends it, Joel's after Hosea. It's just a few pages before Matthew. Anyway, chapter 3 and verse 12, let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. He's talking about that big battle that he's going to draw everybody to. Anyway, put ye in the sickle. Here's that harvest we're talking about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come get you down, for the press is full. The fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. What is the indicator that the day is near? The wickedness is great. That's what it says. And he's talking about the day we're talking about, the day of decision, the day of reckoning, when he's going to tell all the nations to come. Come on, he says, come into my place, and I'm going to reckon with you. The valley of decision. You know that as the Armageddon, and it's prophesied in the Bible extensively. It's pretty clear. There are many other places. I do not have time. I do want to point out, and this is only three now that I've done. I've probably got three or four more to go, and I'll try to finish those next week. But out of these indicators, these are things that you, this is not rocket surgery, you can do this. You can figure this out. You can look at the Bible and you can say, okay, this is what the Bible consistently says about the end of the world. And then you can look around and say, and yes, it's happening. It is happening. It's truly happening. God is trying to convince you to know something without being able to see it yourself, but that you can know something by the evidence that he presents so that you can make a decision by faith to live a certain way in the end times. And if you live that way, God will bless you. God will do something eternal in your life if you live the way he's asking you to live because he gave you the clues. Can you see the day approaching? Next week.